You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
From our studio to yours, this is Various Artists.
Ahi ahi mari e, tēnā koutou katoa, ko mea toka ingoa.
Ko Sophia toku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki Various Artists mō tēnei wiki. Kia ora mea, how are you this week?
Kia ora Soph, I'm good, how are you?
I'm good. We have a really beautiful show today. I'm really looking forward to it. These are two exhibitions that I've really loved in the last couple of
weeks. Me
so
too,
I'm stoked.
Yeah, we were both at the opening. I'm getting ahead of myself.
We're getting ahead of ourselves.
but yes, we were at an opening and it was beautiful.
We went,
we saw, we conquered.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, let's tell the people what we're talking about. What are we doing this week?
Yeah, I've actually got a live interview this week. I will be catching up with artist Brunel Diaz Prims about her current exhibition on At Grace, Mysterium Rationis. So what have you got?
I caught up with director and curator of Gus Fisher Gallery, Lisa Beauchamp, about Studies for a Keepsake, showing artists Claude Cahun and Marcel Moore for the first time in Aotearoa.
He aha o whakara, would love to hear your thoughts on these pieces. So tuku patahi mai, you can text us on 5395 or 5395. Oh no, yeah. Oh, Waimarane. Give us a call in the studio on 309-3879.
Also, after the show, koa e ware ware e ahea na koutou, te whakarongo ki enei kōrero anō hei pakihere roki roki maronga i te pai toku toku irirangi poho me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these chats and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Let's get into the show.
What's it all for?
Various Artists.
Studies for a Keepsake is a new exhibition at Gus Fisher Gallery, tracing the lives and work of pioneering French artists Claude Cahun and Marcel Moore. The exhibition is the first time these artists have been shown in Aotearoa. Working in writing, photography, collage, performance and sculpture, and associated with the surrealist movement in the 20th century, Claude Cahun and Marcel Moore were visionary artists, activists, collaborators and lifelong partners. As gender non-conforming artists, they defied the social norms of the time. For Cahun and Moore, their art was a form of resistance against the context they were living in, defined by warfare, uncertainty, exile, genocide, and fascist political agendas, and the social norms that followed. Their work was virtually forgotten until its rediscovery in the 1990s, paralleling the rise of postmodern feminism as part of this expansion of understanding of identity politics, acknowledging gender as performative rather than fixed, and refusing essentialist feminism. Showing their work in Aotearoa today, Cahun and Moore's legacy lives on through their powerful art making and stories of resistance that continue to resonate with viewers a century later. I had a kōrero with curator Lisa Beauchamp about the exhibition and the lives and work of Claude Cahun and Marcel Moore.
Claude Cahun and Marcel Moore were French artists working during the 1920s, really, in Paris. They were originally associated with the French surrealist movement, but they weren't born in Paris. They were both born in a more rural area called Nantes. And Cahun, in particular, was born into a literary family. So their uncle was, a prominent writer. Their father ran a kind of big local newspaper. So they actually kind of, I suppose, their kind of first entry point into kind of cultural activities was through writing.
Mm.
And similarly with Marcel Moore as well. So Claude Cahun was born Lucy Schwab in 1894, and Marcel Moore was born Suzanne Malherbe a couple of years before. And they holidayed together, their kind of family kind of became connected. They holidayed in Jersey kind of every year. And then, they became very close friends and then lovers and then artistic collaborators. So, kind of initially kind of writing was their kind of first kind of foray into creative kind of activities. And then they began kind of experimenting with photography, collage. They moved to Paris and they contributed writing to various kind of literary journals, became associated with different kind of creatives there, and then it kind of blossomed from that point, really.
I guess what I think is quite interesting about both of them is they never exhibited their images or their practices really during their own lifetimes, which I guess was a big factor in how they remained virtually forgotten until the rediscovery of their work in the 1990s. Are you able to speak a little more to this lack of recognition during their lifetime and later rediscovery, the factors that contributed to that, and how and why perceptions of them and their work shifted in later decades?
I mean, really, we kind of need to remember the context they were working in. So, you know, in Paris, kind of post-World War One, the kind of creative community anyway, very progressive in terms of, you know, kind of thinking thoughts around kind of surrealism and the unconscious, and kind of really pushing the boundaries of the mind, you know, very kind of, Claude in particular was involved with kind of avant-garde theatre as well. Marcel, you know, working a lot with illustration and writing. In 1930, they produced a publication called Avu na Avenu, sometimes translated as kind of cancelled confessions. So it's kind of largely known. So Cahoon kind of did all the writing for that, and Marcel did the collages. And a lot of those collages, so the kind of the portrait photographs that they took, many of those were then kind of incorporated into kind of collages. So they were kind of fragmented and shown within a kind of broader body of work that was collage. So the context they were living in almost kind of, what it really did kind of prevent them showing a lot of their portraiture. And that was to do with the rise of fascism in Europe. Claude Cahoon was Jewish, and so they decided with the rise of fascism and kind of a lot of anti-Semitism at the time, following the Dreyfus affair as well, they both kind of wanted to move to live a more rural lifestyle anyway. And in 1937, they moved to the Channel Island of Jersey. And yeah, they kind of described it as a holiday with no end, you know, that was just, you know, they holidayed there as children and as teenagers. And so it kind of represented this kind of secluded but idyllic kind of lifestyle for them. Mm. And then in 1940, the German military forces occupied Jersey. So that completely changed their lifestyle and the lifestyle of all the residents there, where they, yeah, they were prevented from like listening to the radio, and a lot of houses were requisitioned for German soldiers. And, you know, key to Claude and Marcel's kind of artistic work was also their resistance activity. So that's something that was intertwined with their creative output. So they were completely courageous in the way that they never, you know, they always, yeah, challenged the kind of occupation of Jersey, challenged this kind of horrific kind of political ideology that was kind of sweeping Europe. And they produced lots of resistance kind of notes and leaflets and propaganda that they distributed around the island, and particularly kind of encouraging soldiers to stand down and, you know, not follow Hitler's orders. And actually the two of them, they orchestrated this amazing resistance campaign for about 4 years until they were found out and arrested. And Claude actually described those activities as kind of connecting with their kind of surrealist activities as well. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's really interesting how their kind of activism penetrated both their kind of, you know, you see the portraiture, which is so radical for its time, particularly in the way that they're using costume and they're staging it with props and kind of makeup and really playing with that idea of a fixed gender identity, you know, and this is the early 20s. So they were incredibly brave in the way that they portrayed themselves and kind of probed those stereotypes. And so I think that kind of, that sense of kind of courage and activism kind of filtered through so much of their practice, you know.
Which kind of ultimately censored them at the time?
It did, yeah. It did. And so when they were arrested, the Gestapo raided their home and found their photographs and found a lot of their kind of resistance notes and their photography and artwork. And so a lot of it was kind of destroyed.
Mm.
So what they have now in Jersey Heritage Collections is, you know, their remaining work. But yeah, they deem their portraits, yeah, they weren't acceptable. They kind of completely frowned upon them. Mm. And, you know, because they were kind of, you know, some of them, you know, Claude would be kind of half dressed or kind of, you know, they would show nudity or they would be challenging stereotypes. And yeah, I think for these kind of very kind of fascist conservative viewpoints, they found their imagery degrading, you mm. know, and so yeah, that prevented them very much from showing it.
Mm. I guess it's interesting because, you know, nowadays their work is studied in art history and certainly mm. recognized for its value and its importance. Can you tell me a bit about, I guess, that shift to recognizing their work and ending that censorship?
Yeah, I mean, Claude died when they were 60 and Marcel lived longer and sadly took their own life when they're in their 70s. So, yeah, I mean, when they both passed away, I mean, very much because their work really hadn't been exhibited and shown widely, it did kind of fall into obscurity. And you do get this, I think, with quite a few artists from around that time.
Mm.
And it takes like an art historian or someone like that, you know, to rediscover their work and also really place it within a lineage of kind of artists as well. And I think sometimes that's the, you know, whilst they were associated with the surrealist movement, they weren't kind of really in their inner circle. So these kind of genres that we think of, you know, it's great to think of like the surrealist movement, but actually a kind of, you know, there were so many artists working that were on the periphery as well, you mm. know. So yeah, that rediscovery in the 90s kind of paralleled a kind of, I suppose, a feminist kind of researching and kind of rediscovery of many artists that I suppose were really kind of challenging gender stereotypes and kind of, you know, the way that they were thinking about identities as, you know, plural and kind of performative rather than fixed, kind of paralleled the kind of identity politics at the time as well, kind mm-hmm. of in the 90s. So through that kind of intersectional lens, their kind of work was kind of rediscovered and kind of held up as like this beacon of, you know, how incredible is this work, you know, this has been made in the 20s and 30s, you know. So it kind of makes sense that their work was rediscovered at that point. But also, you know, I think it's important not to just read it through a contemporary lens as well and to understand the context that they were making it in.
Mm.
And very much, you know, they were so unique and individual in the way they approached portraiture, the kind of braveness that they were so bold and incredibly clever in the way that they staged themselves through portraiture. So yeah, you've got that rediscovery, but I think it's important to kind of think about, you know, they were a huge influence on like Cindy Sherman and people like that. Probably Cindy Sherman wouldn't exist if it wasn't for, you know, looking at some of those photographs by Cahoon and Moore, you know. But yeah, I think they're just the most incredible artists, you know, their lives and the work they produce, that it's hard not to be completely just in love with them, really.
Yeah. You know? I wanted to point out as well, with this exhibition, you've made the conscious decision to recognise both artists as co-authors of their work, even though historically these photographs were credited as Cahoon's self-portraits. Can you talk to me a bit about that choice in presenting their work as a duo?
Mm. So, yeah, I feel like this has been a bit of a, you know, there's been various debates. And I think when you're looking back, you know, at history and, you know, no one was there, so they didn't didn't see how these kind of portraits really kind of took place. But it's obvious through the staging and the way that they've been kind of realised that, you know, Cahoon could not have been the subject and the person taking the photograph as well. Mm. And, you know, it's evidence in various bits of writing as well by Cahoon that, you know, their process was a collaborative one. You know, and I think the majority of art historians now would recognise them as co-authors. I think, you know, you always fall into that trap of, yeah, I suppose that kind of, sometimes when you don't recognise a kind of collaboration, sometimes it's about you're kind of holding up this kind of singular artist to be this kind of artistic genius or something, like it's more valuable, which I don't agree with at all. Because, yeah, everything they did, it was a collaboration. Is it a collaboration of the minds? It was, you know, they were, yeah, they absolutely did kind of everything creatively together, you know. Whereas Cahoon is often the subject in the photographs, that doesn't mean that Marcel wasn't involved. You know, they would have been likely very involved in the concept, the staging, the costuming, the props. So it's a collaboration that kind of goes through all the different mediums they worked in, from writing to collage to performance to photography to their resistance activities.
I want to come back a little to something you were talking about a bit before. The rediscovery of Cahoon and Marcel's work paralleled the rise of postmodern feminism as part of this expansion of understanding identity politics, as you say, acknowledging gender as performative rather than fixed and refusing as essentialist feminism. In this vein, their work and identities were very situated in their own genderqueer identities. Are you able to speak a little to this, I guess, slippage of identity and their artistic style that is both a part of and seen within their work?
Yeah. I mean, Cahoon famously said, you know, masculine, feminine, neuter is the only kind of term that kind of suits me. So they were very open in the way that they, yeah, disregarded kind of binary categories and kind of didn't see themselves as fitting within that. I think it's very clear when you see some of the portraits that they are performing, and they're performing almost as lots of different characters, that they, you know, they all kind of connect and they are of one person, but really they are kind of playing out those roles. So that's something that Cahoon did consciously. And yeah, I mean, we've got some really early portraits of Cahoon kind of pre-1920, and they would walk around kind of, you know, Parisian cafes with a shaved head, wearing a men's suit, you know, sometimes with like short hair that they would dye pink, you know. So they were very bold in the way that they expressed themselves through their kind of clothing and their appearance, and that very much comes through the portrait. But yeah, there's an amazing kind of very early portrait where it's a close-up of them and they're kind of looking directly at the camera on their bed, and their hair is kind of splayed out and they're kind of meant to kind of reference Medusa. Then there's a later one which is actually our kind of lead image for the show, where they appear as this kind of boxer, but they're very much in this kind of overtly kind of feminine kind of costuming, and they've got kind of they've got hearts painted on their cheeks, and yeah, and a kind of slogan that's like says, "I'm in training, don't kiss me," you know. So it's this, there's a real playfulness through that comes through the portraits. There's another one which is very kind of Cindy Sherman-esque. So Cahoon wore lots of masks as well in their work, and it was that kind of very, yeah, clear way of kind of, you know, changing up and wearing a different mask for a different persona, you know. So there's one where they appear almost very doll-like with this very, this mask that covers their face. And then they've got attached to their cloak these like Venetian Colombina masks. So kind of Venetian ball type masks. And the kind of the multiplicity of all of those masks is quite interesting, thinking about, you know, you're donning a different mask every time you feel like kind of being a different kind of person or a personality. So, yeah, there's lots of, I'd say that there's a real kind of sense of performance and kind of playfulness with the way they present themselves. And, yeah, really thinking about kind of identity as something that is malleable and always changing.
And, yeah, I think like what you've said before, trying not to apply a contemporary lens to them, you think about the context in which they're, you know, creating work like that and having those identities is quite amazing. And I think it's just such an important reminder that queer people have always existed and have always been there no matter the context in which they're living in.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, that is a key point behind doing the show as well, that it's important for rainbow communities to see themselves reflected in the past as much as the present. And, you know, looking back, you know, 100 years, you know, you're seeing this work and you're learning about these incredible individuals who were living life as they saw fit, you know, despite living in a very dangerous and divided society. You know, they were completely committed to absolutely being themselves, you know. And I think that's an important message that we kind of need to remember now.
It's so powerful. It makes you feel quite emotional.
Like, it does.
Even seeing the show, it's just like...
Yeah. Gosh. It does. I know. I got tingles when I like saw some of the portraits on the wall, because also I feel like, you know, I studied these artists in art history, like, you know, moons ago, but I never thought I'd, you know, be able to put a show of their work on, you know. And it's just, it's been so great being able to kind of... think about how we're going to present it, and, you know, being able to be flexible with the scale of the images as well has been amazing. And just seeing details in some of these works that you've never seen before, you know, because you're just looking online or in a book, you know. So I think hopefully people will really connect to it and get a lot from it.
Yeah, totally. I guess you kind of touched on it there, but I'm going to ask you anyway, just because I think it's important. This is, as you say, the first time Kahuna Moore have been exhibited in Aotearoa, which I think has its own significance in and of itself. But I think it's a really interesting and important time within our political climate to be exhibiting them. The exhibition, of course, aligns with the 40th anniversary of the Homosexual Law Reform Act of 1986 in Aotearoa, all while we're seeing our government propose the legislation definitions of woman and man amendment bill, which would effectively write genderqueer, trans, takatāpui and non-binary New Zealanders out of the law. I guess for you, what do you think the significance is of bringing Kahuna Moore to Aotearoa audiences?
Yeah, I think, well, it feels incredibly timely. And yeah, I think what's happening in regards to, you know, the government at the moment here is just really shocking and disappointing, and just another way of just bullying, you know, people. And I think looking back at, you know, Kahuna Moore's work, you just, there's so incredibly powerful people who, who went against a lot of social norms at the time. I mean, this was 100 years ago. I kind of think it's a, you know, I can't find the right word, but I think I can't believe that we're still debating this 100 years on, you know, and we're, you know, somehow seeing certain people as a threat to other people. And it's just completely wrong. So, I think in a positive way, I hope that people find this exhibition affirming. I hope they feel a sense of connection. We're going to be doing lots of great events with the public programme. We've got a special event with the Charlotte Museum where we're going to be going and visiting the Charlotte Museum and seeing some of their archive related to the kind of homosexual law reform. So that's going to be really exciting. We've got a variety of talks and workshops. We've got film screenings. So I think hopefully, you know, the exhibition will, generate timely and important conversations. Hopefully, you know, I just think at the time, like, Kahuna Moore was so, they always believed in the ability of to change people's minds. They never, even when, you know, they were doing these resistance activities and, you know, all this, you know, horrendous stuff was happening in Jersey with the occupation, they never really blamed the German troops or the German soldiers. They always believed that individually they could change, people can change their minds. And I think that is such a important thing to remember, you know, that, you know, even if you might not agree with someone's viewpoints, you know, it is possible for people to kind of reassess and really think about, you know, what's happening and to change their minds for the better. So, and I think that relates to a lot of things happening at the moment. So, yeah, hopefully the exhibition will, I don't know, be a little prompt in the right direction.
Yeah, I hope so. That was curator of Gus Fisher Gallery, Lisa Beauchamp, speaking to me about Studies for a Keepsake, the first exhibition in Aotearoa to be showing pioneering French artists Claude Cahun and Marcel Moore. As Lisa mentioned, there is a really excellent public program running alongside the show. Tomorrow, Lisa and co-curator Ruth Minha will be hosting a co-curator tour of the exhibition from 2 till 3 p.m., so definitely go check that out. And then there's lots of other events to check out over the coming months, which you can find more information on their website. The exhibition is on at Gus Fisher until the 22nd of August, so be sure to head on over.
Yes, darling, but is it art?
Hidden classics, pushing the limit. Gonna read it as they told it. Gonna make my own, put it on a disc, live in the classics.
Good art.
Brunel Diaz-Prims is a painter whose practice explores the notions of the extended self by pointing the lens outward onto her own personal surroundings and extended environments, examining her personal orbit and allowing these threads of connection to form between moments and places in her life. In her current exhibition on At Grace, Mysterium Rationis, Diaz-Prims presents a beautiful body of paintings that circulate around her family's recent travels. Caught in between moments of awe and admiration, while also finding herself in places of critique on these wider notions of tourism and travel. The work itself draws from these diaristic images taken by Diaz-Prims on her travels, imagery of galloping horses, cherubs, monkeys and trees, and frescoes, humming throughout the show, pulling the viewer into the space of temporality, sitting between the space of the recorded image and the artist's own memory and feelings of that place. We've got Brunel on the line now. Kia ora, Brunel. How are you today?
Hi, I'm good, thank you. Thanks for having me.
No worries, thank you so much. Now, let's get a bit into the show. Would you like to start off by introducing yourself and your overall practice a little bit?
Yeah, so I'm a figurative painter currently based in Mangawhai, And yeah, my practice is interested in the figure and ground relationships as a way to explore the interconnection between the self and the environment, sacredness and temporality.
Beautiful. And your current exhibition on At Grace, Mysterium Rationis, presents a beautiful body of paintings that draw from family travel and tourism. I wanted to start this conversation around the exhibition by speaking a little bit to its beginnings. Where did this body of work gain its initial momentum from? Was there a specific idea or experience that really drove your approach into the making of the work?
I think technically this body of work sort of references my travels to Europe with my mum and also my uncle and auntie, but it was mainly with my mum that I was traveling with. We traveled to Portugal, Spain and Italy, and their subsequent influential cities like Lisbon, Sevilla, and Rome. In kind of traveling to these places, I sort of kept thinking about my personal and kind of familial historical, influence that these countries have had on myself, kind of even without knowing. For example, being of Goan descent, the Portuguese colonized Goa, and so a lot of that cross-cultural influence was definitely obviously present in Goa, and then going back to this country, which I'd never stepped foot in, it was a really uncanny experience recognizing some of those cultural things that I thought was just part of what we do, but it was so much grander and wider than I kind of thought, And then also being baptized as a Roman Catholic and then being in Rome and kind of looking through the streets of Sevilla through the Holy Week, Santa Semana processions, all of these kind of situations were like coming home, but also it was very far and distant from what I'd known of myself, but yet we were connected. So that was kind of the initial beginnings of this body of work.
And I feel as though this use of imagery, there has been a slight shift in orientation compared to that of your previous work, which often held a more inward perspective, with depictions of familial scenes revealing personal moments across dinner tables and homes, allowing the viewer into your own personal interior. And although these works still offer this diaristic approach from this personal lens, they're does seem to be a shift outward onto a more extended and larger environment. Do you want to speak a little bit more to this decision behind the shift in lens, or rather its more outward and extended position in this exhibition?
Yeah, so as I kind of touched on just before, I think just during connections to Portugal, and Rome in this kind of uncanny way, I sort of started thinking about my practice, which was very embedded in my immediate environment, what is familiar, what is my surroundings, and it was quite interior, as you put it. But then, I guess, funnily enough, with traveling with your family to geographies that are so much further, technically further away from what you think is home, actually kind of brings you closer to it in a strange way. So although my practice was initially kind of interested in homing, I think the idea of belonging now feels more broader, and I think my practice is kind of always been interested in touching on ideas of globalism. I think just with the internet and us all being products of you know, media and just the way of the world at the moment, we're all kind of connected in these weird, you know, ways, and the world feels kind of smaller. Mm. So I think in, yeah, in more ways than one, I think these travels helped me think about belonging in a kind of, in a different way beyond geography. And yeah, kind of in a wider circle kind of way, and in a kind of uncanny kind of way too.
Yeah, because it's that like quite shifter though, even though these works are from that personal lens, someone as a viewer might not quite see that as they first initially walk around, but that whole idea of you're pushing the self's environment kind of outward and forming those into connections between these different places.
Yeah. And then I guess the self is not just you know, what is diaristic is, what is the connection, sorry, in my practice is actually what is me. It's kind of like, it's not really about the spaces. It's about what I see in the world and what I connect with, as opposed to just generally being a boundary of, oh, I live here in Mangawhai, for example, so whatever's around me is the connection. No, actually, it's whatever I see is kind of the thing that binds the practice.
Yeah, and the works in the show, they kind of embody the souvenir of sorts of your traveling, but the works also take on this slight critique of travel and the family holiday. How do you go about walking this line of admiration and awe and critique within the work? What occurs in that space and process of reframing the travel image into that space of the painting?
I think that's a really good question. I think because I was a passenger on this trip, it was kind of a trip that was not necessarily meant for me, because I, my stepdad was meant to make it and then he didn't. And anyway, I won the lottery of being on this trip. I think on a kind of personal level, I felt like I naturally have an inclination to criticism, and I couldn't help but kind of put my my rational mind on and my intellectual mind and kind of critique the tourism industry, critique the souvenir shops and the masses of people, even though ironically, I was part of it. I kind of chose to believe that I was not. And there's a certain kind of snobbery that I kind of inhabited in these travels. And I became very aware of that. And I think when I went back to my studio months later and started thinking about my own, like reflecting on these travels, there were definitely moments where I was, you know, critiquing the industry and consumerism and capitalism, and as you said, there were definitely moments of like grace that I found within those spaces. Like I felt moved, actually, surprisingly, when looking at some of the frescoes. Yes, on one hand, you know, you can't help but grapple with the kind of pain and toil of what these institutions have done, and it's not to minimize that by any means, but I think just through these travels, I also found, maybe it was just through traveling with my mum, you know, she's a working class woman and she saved up all of her money to go here, I felt a real sense of authenticity and genuineness, and I thought, gosh, I think what I want to capture here is the sense that you can have these complex relationships with you know, truth, that something can be both difficult and challenging and something, and yet it can still be full of grace and love. And so this criticism of tourism and the industry and all of that is kind of led me to think about these bigger moral issues on maybe just, yeah, personal feelings of finding grace even in a place that I would usually criticize, I guess, or challenge.
Yeah, totally. And I also wanted to delve into the making process of the works themselves. Mm-hmm. These paintings have such a beautiful, almost airiness and open quality to them, with a lot of the works having these really delicate moments of transparent washes of paint that speak to a kind of dissolution in memory, but of a recording of movement, while other works lean into the build-up of surface and the recording of these layered movements across the canvas. Do you want to speak a bit to these alternative modes of painterly application within your work?
Yeah, I think what I was interested when I went back to my studio was reflecting on my experience as a tourist and with these kind of juxtapositioning ideas of both challenge or like me challenging certain ideas or being challenged by certain institutions like the Vatican, but also finding grace and the flurry of movement, of travel, the temporality, the kind of kaleidoscopic feeling of being from one church, going from one church to another, and this kind of, when you see one fresco, you kind of end up feeling like you've seen many. That kind of, that state of movement and the kind of cyclical nature of things, that was what I wanted to capture, as opposed to, say, representing the master's work. It's not that I, yeah, that's kind of far from the truth. I wasn't even trying to touch on that, but I was trying to touch on the experience of looking at said images, said master's works. So, yeah, with that comes, I think naturally I'm inclined to painting fast and thinly. I kind of see my work as, you know, washes and kind of tending lightly to the canvas as though that it was skin itself. And yet there are times where I really took my time to paint as though I was mimicking a master's technique. So in God of My Mothers is depicted, I think, 5 or 6 green Madonnas, which are glow-in-the-dark Madonnas that I saw in a souvenir shop, which took me straight back to my childhood. And I wanted to recreate I wanted to kind of integrate my understanding, or like my childhood understanding of Catholicism, for example, or religiosity, through a very humble lens, and by painting it on a 13th century gesso recipe on board like the old masters would. It was kind of elevating something that I criticized in that souvenir shop, like, oh, look at all these plastic objects and gosh, all of these idols here. It was a way of actually renouncing some of those criticisms and kind of really seeing even love within the plasticity of these Madonnas, that they actually come from a very humble way of working class people trying to connect to something divine, you know, God. So yeah, this sort of, those are the kinds of ways that I like to deal with paint, depending on what I'm painting and what I'm trying to convey.
Beautiful. And how much do you tend to go off the original, like, reference imagery itself, and how much of it is kind of this memory and feeling of a place along with this kind of painterly intuition that seeps in? Are there moments in the making of work where you really allow the painting and the material and the feeling to kind of gain a kind of agency within the work itself?
Yeah, totally. I think I see, you know, photographs as a way of just, they're just a starting point to my practice. Mm. They're just drawings. But after that, what's on the canvas kind of, it's, you know, my mind is focused on the canvas. And there are certain, you know, with figurative painting and with trying to represent, you know, aspects of reality, I can't shy away from certain conventions that photography or drawing from reality helps. But ultimately, it is the dance between the figure and the ground, the background and the foreground. That is what excites me. It's the edges. As my, I remember my lecturer from AUT, Simon McIntyre, saying it's the edges that interest me. It's the edge between the figure and the ground, that kind of vibration. What happens? What happens when the figure and the ground kiss? That's what I'm interested in. And I love the way that I can explore that within the field of the canvas. So totally, I feel like, yeah, as a starting point, photographs are really helpful. And they're a great tool. And then it's just me and the canvas and kind of being very present with what is happening in the image at that moment.
Yeah, lovely. So you really allow for this, to connect with the painting itself and let that kind of have agency and kind of guide the making of the work itself.
Yeah.
Yeah, lovely. And lastly, what are your hopes for audiences engaging with the show?
If anyone has been to my previous show, group show at Gus Fisher called Dreaming From Afar, with Gian Manik, and Tyrone Tewa, I think this show is a particularly, poignant and, softer, I think, extension of that exhibition. Kind of feels like a softer part two of that body of work. It deals with ideas around existentialism, faith, cultural critiques, personal criticisms. You know, no one is safe, but it's soft and it's kind, and it's pun not intended, because it is held in grace, but there is a lot of grace in that show. And when naming the show and kind of thinking about all these ideas, I just kept thinking about if I was being the house of reason, then I found grace within it. You know, there's a really wonderful, I feel like the show at the heart of it is a way to, or kind of speaks to, reconciling with some of those difficult truths and complexities, and that it's okay for things to be left open and be like, yeah, there are things, there are institutions, there are truths that challenge us, and there can also be love within that. Mm. And that's that, you know, it's awkward and it's open. Mm. So I hope people find that engaging. And if anything, if you're just like a real geek for painting, then I think you really enjoy the show, because there's a lot of movement, there's gesture, there's figuration, there's a love for the tradition, but it's not holding back gesture as well. So I hope that the audience just enjoys, you know, everything paint has to offer.
Yeah, great. And congratulations on such a beautiful show. And thank you so much for taking the time for talking to us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Maya.
Sweet. Thank you so much. Have a lovely rest of your day.
Awesome. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Sweet. And for our listeners, that was Brunel Diaz-Prim speaking to me about her current solo exhibition on At Grace, Mysterium Rationis. The show is on until the 13th of June, so be sure to go check that one out.
Only positive critiques. Honest.
Various artists. It's the 95 BFM Art Guide on various artists. It's paintings in that.
This week in the wonderful world of art in Tamaki Makaurau. As mentioned on the show, Studies for a Keepsake, an exhibition showing Claude Cahoon and Marcel Moore, is on now at Gus Fisher Gallery until the 20th of August. Also on at Gus Fisher is a solo exhibition by Lucy Mail, Phone Tree, also on until the 22nd of August.
Also mentioned on the show, Brunel Dias Prim solo exhibition Mysterium Rationis is on at Grace Aotearoa until the 13th of June.
Opening tomorrow at Te Uru Waitakere Contemporary Gallery is Cosmologies, an exhibition by Nico Hinden and Naminapu Meimuru White, as well as a new group exhibition, All the Forest Stands With You. The opening is from 4 p.m, so head along.
Dark Matter, a group exhibition showing Simon Endres, Harry Kelly, Simon Atwell and Kirsten Roberts is on at Melanie Roger Gallery until the 6th of June.
Ma Sheng Fung Ho, a solo exhibition by Audrey Goggin, is on at Window Gallery until the 24th of June.
The Blue Dome by Selena Oshadi is on at Artspace Aotearoa until the 4th of July.
Revolutionary Mania by Luke Willis Thompson is on at Coastal Signs until the 6th of June. If you have something you want on the Art Guide, you can email us at arts@95bfm.com.
That was the 95BFM Art Guide.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa e koro mai ki maua mō tēnei rā.
That's all for various artists for today. Ngā mihi nui to everyone who spoke with us.
Lisa Beauchamp.
And Brunel Dias-Prims.
Nei rā, hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in.
And remember, you can listen back to all of today's pieces on 95BFM.com or check out our Instagram at 95BFM various artists for more.
Ka hoki mai mātou a te rā wiki. Next up is The Land of the Good Groove. My name is Soph.
I'm Maya.
And that was Various Artists.
We'll catch you next week.
You're listening to 95BFM. Ka kite.
Whoa!
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.